Well, welcome back to the Jazzed Podcast. Today is a special day. We have someone who I've always looked up to, and I think jazz fans everywhere look up to you. The voice of the Utah Jazz, Craig Bowlerjack, is with me here. Craig, welcome. How are you?
Matt, thanks. Kind words. I appreciate the time, and let's have fun.
I think everyone knows who Craig Bowlerjack is, but I don't think people understand the origins of Bowler, how your broadcast career started, where all that began. Talk to me just a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I was a sports enthusiast since I remember walking. You know, things just baseball, t-ball, softball, basketball, football was my love, track and field, baseball. Anything that was competitive, I kind of found myself involved with. And I was never pushed, you know, by my dad, my mom. It was just something I always enjoyed. I was always out in the neighborhood trying to get a game up and that type of thing. And I had a really fun time in high school. We had a very good high school football team. Played for the state championship my junior year. And a lot of scholarship offers came to many of us back in those days. And Kansas State was like a walk-on opportunity. And I hurt my knee, and all that stuff's been talked about too many times. But when I got there, I realized I just couldn't play at that level any longer. Two knee operations, and so you're done. And I could have gone to junior college and maybe rehab, but I had this girlfriend who kind of convinced me to follow her to school. And how many times do you hear that from? I would have gone here, but Kansas State, my brother was there, and I had some friends going, so it seemed like a natural fit. I was discouraged, I got to be honest, because I was actually a biology major when I first went there. I love science. People may not know that. You know, I did well in high school in tests, and I quizzed out of freshman biology, which I thought, wow, why? I didn't know that was possible. But so they put me in some advanced classes, which I was not prepared for, and I almost quit school because football, that was really my whole focus. My brother kind of got a hold of me and directed me to the School of Broadcast Journalism that Kansas State has. And I started taking some elective courses, and ding, it's just like, this is what I want to do. It keeps me close to a passion that I've had since I can remember. And I dove into it, Matt, really like it was a job. And I think that's what helped me to understand the hours it takes, preparation it takes, and I guess, you know, the dedication of any job. But I learned early, about 19, that look, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to jump in head first, and that's kind of the approach I took.
When you walk into the Jazz media room, at least this is how it used to be before the arena was renovated.
Right.
You see right in front of you, there's this picture, and there's Hot Rod Hundley.
Sure.
And next to Hot Rod, there's this young man, this really, really healthy head of just black hair.
Yeah.
And it's Craig Bowlerjack.
Yeah.
So when I see that, I think, I didn't realize Bowler worked with Hot Rod this early on. Tell me a little bit about working with Hots and like, what was that?
How it happened.
Yeah.
Well, the story goes like this. I came to Salt Lake in 1985. So there it is. I'm out. I was only 12 though. Okay. Jim Nance and I, great friends, and we haven't talked much of late, but he's kind of started a new life on the West Coast, and you know, he got out of New York, but still works obviously and is the face of CBS, where I would go later. But Jim left and got a job at CBS as their college scoreboard host, and I got a call one night from, I think it was Spence Kennard, news director, who said, Craig, by the way, part of what you're going to be doing is being Hot Rod's analyst. And I thought, are you kidding me? You know, he ought to be the analyst. And he really was. I mean, I was only there because I represented KSL. But man, we had a great time. Gosh, Hot Rod and I really bonded the moment I came to town. And it was such a sad day when Hot's passed. But that year that I helped call games, I think we had a contract to call 8 or 10 games. And that was when Frank was the head coach and Jerry had just come on a little bit later. And it was just as fun as could be. We had more fun. I remember one night at the old LA Coliseum, or the Forum. Yeah, the Forum, Magic Johnson. We're doing an open live and Magic puts a jumper off the rim, knocks me in the back of the head, and my head was ringing. you know, for like a minute, and Hot Rod put the phone, the microphone down on the floor and was laughing so hard he walked away. And then we had to restart again. But, you know, Magic came over like, "Hey, man, I'm really sorry about that. Wasn't on purpose." I said, "Yeah, sure. No, no. Hey, Magic, do whatever you do whatever you want to do." But that was a fun time. And Hot Rod was just a laugh a minute. And as he always said, he was America's guest. And he was a dear, dear friend.
So in my job with the Jazz, I got a couple opportunities to talk with Hot Rod.
Yeah.
One was his retirement ceremony at halftime. I was the person who kind of guided him to half court. And he was always so happy, just so nice, so outgoing, and just wanted to just love talking about basketball, asking people questions. Someone who knew him really, really well. What did you take from him that you use in your career?
Well, you know, Hot Rod was a guy that was loved people, and he loved to be a showman. And I think when you look back at old video of him playing at West Virginia and his short career in the NBA, that's kind of who he truly was. His documentary is dynamic. It really tells a story of really no mother, no father, and that basketball was his escape out of West Virginia, and was the number one pick in the NBA draft. Didn't make much money. I think $10,000 was the going rate at that time. Is that amazing?
It is.
And he always said, you know, "Damn, I wish I could have been born about 30 years later." Every time you talk Hotch, you have to use his voice. He's the most impersonated guy around. But his voice was so dynamic and recognizable. And, you know, I listened to him, and I kind of got to know and understand why he was who he was. And so the showmanship from his early childhood just was who he was. It made him happy. It made him happy to see people laugh. And he loved to tell the stories, mostly of himself. But there was always some catch or some joke that went with it. And he always just felt good, I think, Matt, right? You felt good being around him. Mm-hmm. And that was the beauty of Rod. And he was able to describe the game during such an important tenure of the Jazz history with Stockton to Malone. Stockton to Malone. I mean, how many times did we hear that? And I covered the Jazz on a local basis, you know, from 85 before I left in 98. You just couldn't even talk Jazz without Stockton Malone. And Hot Rod was such a big part of bringing that alive, both on television and radio.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, just the catchphrases. In 98, I was 14. And those are the days when you're a kid, when you're just out in the front yard in the driveway shooting hoops, and you're literally saying, Stockton Malone, hippity hop, you know, just
hippity hop, hippity hop.
All the things Hot Rod would say.
Yeah.
It went down to every level of Jazz fanhood. How does that feel for you now, you know, whether it's, you know, Money Man or the phrases that you create?
Right.
Little kids are out in the front yard saying things you say. What is that like?
It's really amazing. You bring up an interesting point I don't really try to think about too much, because my dad, who will be 87 at the end of October, he always has told me, look, plow your own field. And that resonates with me. I had to replace Paul James at Channel 5, who was iconic and the BYU voice on radio forever, and who passed away just not long ago. And then I had to, you know, I was given the opportunity to get on with the Jazz 15 years ago. I mean, this is unbelievable how fast time has gone. And I was scared. I got to be honest. I mean, you know, it's hard to think I'm going to replace. You don't replace a legend, okay? You just don't. And so I go back to my original thought was, look, just go out and do what you do. Plow your own field. You know the city. You know the team. You've been there. You're fortunate to cover the Jazz during the heyday of Stockton and Malone, and you knew Coach Sloan and Frank, and use that to your, you know, hopefully to your advantage. But you know, those nicknames just kind of just pop out of nowhere. Memo was money, and he loved it. And I remember the late Larry Miller came up to me one night and said, "Bowler, look, here's the deal. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but Memo's up for a contract, and you're calling Money Man." And he starts laughing, you know, like, he's going to kill me on this deal. But he goes, "No, I never tell you not what to say." And I always thought that was cool of Larry, but he, you know, he had a bit of a humorous side to him. But, you know, it's an honor, honestly, man, I tell you, to be a part of this franchise and to have the legacy of Hot Rod, you know, supporting me. And I try not to put too much pressure on myself, but I just go out, like my dad said, plow the field. And that's what I've tried to really do. And let things come naturally. I've never, in broadcasting, the one thing I tell young students is don't force it. what comes naturally, the fans understand. You and I were just talking before we came on about how intelligent the fan is, and they sense if the real person is behind the mic or not. And I think that's the most important thing. Hot Rod had his real, the real side to him, and he expressed that every night. And those fans have grown up, and I've been fortunate to have young fans now grow up with me. And when I see them at the arena, it's like, wow, you just don't realize that they are such diehard fans, and they will, you know, replicate some of the lines that you come up with, like, you know, Joe, corner three, bang. I mean, people just, that just came normal one night and naturally, and it's just one of those things. Same thing with Money Man. And Memo just loved it so much. He'd look at me and rub his fingers, you know, and as he was backpedaling. And those are just special moments. And Jingle and Joe and Slow Mo Joe, all those things just happen. I think that's what's the most, the beauty of it is, if it comes naturally, it makes a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, you know, kids today growing up with you as the jazz voice. Well, kids from my era also grew up with you as the guy at KSL.
Yeah, yeah.
So my first memories of Craig Bowler Jack were you at KSL. And Show Me the Title.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think there's an entire generation of jazz fans who know that phrase.
Sure.
And can tell you exactly what it was and where they were and just loved it. That era of Show Me the Title with Big Dog, about that era of your life, pre-jazz, but, you know, like the finals years and kind of covering something that was really maybe the biggest sporting event that Utah's had in and still.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. You know what happened when we were at KSL? We were given a lot of freedom, and television's changed drastically. But KSL was at a point with Spence Kennard, who was our news director, and then later that changed, and Ray Carter came in and really gave us free reign. Sports Beat Sunday was off and running. And that was something to me was so exciting because we brainstormed it and the sales guys came down and said, you know what, maybe we can sell this. The next week it was 8 minutes, then it went to 15, then it went to 30. And then all of a sudden we had the spinoff on Sound Off. So it was a full hour on a Sunday night and the ratings were insane. People were staying up to watch a chance to ask Karl Malone a question by way of telephone. Or Jerry Sloan. It was unreal.
I called in as a kid.
Did you?
Oh, yeah, of course. So, yeah.
Here's Matt. What's your question, Matt? Welcome to Sports Beat. Yeah. You know, Ty Detmer on his Heisman run. I mean, it was unbelievable how much fun we had, and we kind of made it a local sports center. And we went through all the highlights, both nationally and locally, and it was well produced. I had some terrific people that I worked with that really made it happen, because without them behind the scenes, it just doesn't work. What happened was when the Jazz were really starting to make that move, we were sitting around brainstorming one night, and at that time there really wasn't the regulations today, Matt, inside the arena. Most all of us did our sports shows 6 and 10 from the floor, and so we said we ought to come up and do like a 30-minute, you know, recap during this playoff run, because there was a lot of talk, much like now, that the Jazz are going to be in the finals, or at least in the Western Conference finals. And so Jerry Maguire, show me the title, show me the money, show me the money. And we came up with, why not show me the title? It just went like wildfire. Mm-hmm. The governor was in on it. Steve Young was, you know, doing the dance. And we'd have a different personality every night, you know, open up the show with show me the title. And it just took off. And it was one of the probably 2 years, those 97 and 98 title runs against Chicago were as intense, ad lib, off the cuff, really tested us as journalists to go out and do the job and also to entertain. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people behind watching us. We had the support of KSL and also the support of the Jazz. And then they realized later on, well, heck, we got to be able to do this once they had the K-Jazz television that came aboard, and we weren't allowed to do as much. But those 2 years are so special. And I've got a couple of posters around the house of Big Dog, who was perfect, by the way, for that, along with Rod Zundel and others. And I those are some of the most fun memories I have in broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as someone, like I mentioned, growing up in that era, like, I guess, thanks, because it was really fun to watch. And I mean, I was just a kid. I was just, you know, ninth grade or whatever. I think it just made those runs that much more fun.
Yeah.
Because I really wanted to see what you had to say and who was going to be on. And
oh, we had the national media in as well. We had Trapper Jones come on, Bob Costas, Hannah Storm. We had Greg Gumbel, who I would work with later at CBS, and Bill Walton. I mean, those guys were really easy. Just say, hey, you want to come by and sit down in the chair for a minute? Yeah, man, stop by. And we'd have like a 3 or 4 minute conversation post-game about what went down and what to expect. And then, of course, the shot in Houston that Stockton hit that let the Jazz go to the NBA Finals will always be a moment in time that is just frozen for me, because I was just off to the right side of the basket getting ready to come on to do Show Me the Title. And I'm thinking, that ball's going in. And we're off to Chicago. And lo and behold, the next 10 minutes is a blur. But all I remember is the jumping and maybe the most emotional moment I've ever seen Jerry Sloan, that he actually was going to the NBA Finals against the Chicago Bulls, where it all happened for him as a player.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
I didn't realize, I mean, I never really thought about, you know, you were there.
Yeah.
And when that moment happens, did you kind of, I know it, as a videographer, did your camera guy rush the court? Like, were you rushing the court to try to get a shot? Like, I know you say that 10 minutes was a blur, but
it was.
That was the apex so far of the Utah Jazz, is that moment, and you were there.
Yeah, we were there, baseline, right side, and yes, we just kind of went with the flow, the wave of photographers, and the floor was an absolute melee, and we're trying to get those quick, instant responses. That's the beauty of the old days, is that before now, most athletes want to shower and take the game off of them and then put on the clothes. And from my experience, the greatest moments I've had interviewing a player is the immediacy of the moment, not 15 or 17 minutes later when that moment's gone, washed down the drain in the shower. It's that moment. And those moments are, I cherish all those, because that's when you get the real emotion, the raw emotion of the moment. And that's what the fans, I think, deserve.
I know you're not from Utah.
No.
And you have, I know that as a part of the media, there's this line where, you know, you're not a fan, you can't cheer. Obviously, calling a game is a little different, but how do you navigate that line between fan and broadcaster?
It's a great question. I get asked that on occasion, and I think the fact I'm not from here gives me a little bit of a direction, of a base. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not a Jazz fan. I've followed this team since 85, and I've been at the big moments as you as a kid. You lived it. I saw it. Now I work for them, which is an incredible opportunity that I didn't think would ever happen. But it did. And, you know, working at the network also gave me, I think, a good perspective at CBS and ESPN and Fox, Matt, where, again, your job was to call it right down the middle. And back in those days, if you got an email before text became what it is today, if you got kind of a half and half, hate you, love you response, then you know you did your job, because you're not going to please everyone. And calls go against the team, or you may get excited on a 101-yard kickoff return only because you're living the moment. It's not the fact that Alabama or Georgia or Florida, when I was working the SEC, is my favorite team. No, I prepared for both teams like it was, like you're supposed to do. That's responsibility that you have. And I can't help that one night Alabama or Auburn may beat one or the other, you know, by a late second field goal. And that's what, as a broadcaster, you live for, that moment. And so those emotions rise and the fans get angry. Ah, you were pulling for Bama anyway. So I've heard all that. And so you have to have thick skin. But at the same time, the Jazz, I think, is so intriguing, Matt, is that BYU and Utah will always have that blue, red, whatever it may be. That's why I hope it, even though they're taking a hiatus, I guess, in early 2020 with what, 2-3, that rivalry should never go away. But what the beauty of this fan base is, in my opinion, Matt, is that they all come together for the Utah Jazz. Wow. I mean, it's the city, it's the state, it's the region, it's the Intermountain West team. And it's gone beyond that too. I think with Donovan and Rudy now, it's international with Joe Ingles and Dante. It's an international game. And everywhere we go, I'm stunned how many jerseys of Donovan, Rudy, old days of Faves. Harpring says it's his 15, but it's really Derek's. Carl and John. That the momentum of the Jazz franchise is at a really high boiling point. And all over the NBA, wherever we go, there's Jazz fans where we go. And that's what's happened. The Jazz is belongs to everybody, and Gail made that very clear when she put it into a trust. And if it stays that way, they're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's really quite a commitment by the Miller family, and I'm glad to be a part of it.
The day-to-day of what you do. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned, you know, preparing for Alabama, preparing for Georgia, preparing for these teams. I don't think anyone is, you know, ignorant to think that, oh, you just show up and call a game. Tell me just kind of behind the curtain of a game day, what goes into the prep? Are you watching film? Are you watching plays? Are you at practice? Like, how is it for you?
Yeah, we're one of few broadcast teams that are allowed, the Jazz allow us to come in and watch practice and shoot arounds, which is great. I'll usually get three or four, as we call it in the business, a nugget that I'm going to relay to the fans during the course of the game. You know, in my office here that we're setting, it's pretty cluttered. I got all my press passes that I keep. I've got to get a bigger bucket. But, you know, I've got game notes that I have, and I wish fans would see those. Those are the prep cards that I do for every game, and I do it by hand. A lot of people think, God, Buller, that's a waste. But, you know, that's how I learned it. My mind kind of takes a photograph of what I do by my own hand in different colors. And then I highlight most of those bullet points in yellow. And that brings it to my eye when I'm calling a game. The game is so fast, unlike football, where you have a little breathing time and your analyst is going to do a couple of angle replays. And I can kind of get my mind back to focus. And usually at that time, the producer's talking to us about the next promo or when we're going to break, that type of thing. But with basketball, it's such a fast game. So you have to trust your preparation, and then your recall, because you really can't just sit there and verbatim read what you wrote. It's kind of bullet point type of journalism where I just write down three or four key words, and then I ad-lib the rest of the game. And that's my challenge. That's what I love about being in the play-by-play seat, is that nothing is scripted. It's what you learn and how much that you can put out during the course of the game. Some things you leave on the floor. Some things you never even speak about. If it's a close game, all you're doing is hoop. But sometimes we've been involved in 30-point blowouts on both sides, and so you're good to have information that you work with. So to make a long story short, on a game day particularly, we will go to practice or shoot around. We'll have a production meeting with Travis and JB and the rest of our staff, Matt T., who's ever calling the game with me on that particular night. And we kind of just draw out what the hot topics are for the Jazz. And then once we decide that and what the graphics are going to be, the storylines and how we're going to open the game, I come back and write like a little 30-second hyped, looking back and looking forward video that I love writing. And so I get a chance to write that, and then the production staff puts it together, and then we just go to work. And I probably prepped the night before or on the plane for the next game, and then I go back and I kind of just write little notes on how we're going to open up, and then we call the game and we do it all over again the next day. So I do interview Quinn on a nightly basis, which is good, and that gives me a great insight before we come on camera and off of what actually is going on. And we have a good relationship. I hope he believes that. But at the same time, I think fans have to realize too that even though I work for the team, and man, I know you know this because of your educational background, there's a certain line you just don't cross. And he knows that. And all the coaches I've worked with, some have a message, some want something, you know, out there, and you try to work it in, but you have to kind of keep that relationship, you know, down a kind of a tight line. And I think, you know, Quinn and I do that the best we can.
So along the same lines of what we're talking about, kind of prepping for games and teams, one area that is fascinating to me also is the travel. I never was with the team on a, you know, every game basis like you, but there were times, you know, where I would go to playoffs or summer league or random events, and traveling is hard. Okay. So I think most fans just think, oh, you're on this amazing jet and you get the food and blah, blah, blah. I go to Hawaii for a week. I have a hard time sleeping, right? Yeah, I'm in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I can't sleep in a bed that's not my bed. I need my own pillow. I don't know. I sound like my 3-year-old right now, but I think when you say it's a grind,
it is a grind.
I think it is like the literal sense. Tell me what it's like. I know that the NBA is kind of doing away with 4 games and 5 nights and things like that, but you're on a 6-game road trip. You're not going to be home in your own bed for
10 days.
Yeah, 2 weeks, whatever it is. What is that like when you, you know, let's say you're in Houston, game ends, we win, close game, you got to do all your post game, you got to get right to the plane because you're going to Dallas and you're getting into Dallas at 3 a.m. and then you get right to the hotel, you play the next day. So give us a little, from your point of view, I get it, you know, you're on a charter jet.
Right.
However, traveling is really hard.
It is.
But what is it like for you?
It is. We call it living in the tube. And let me just explain that. The tube has basically 4 stops. It obviously starts in the airplane. That's your first tube. You get off the plane, you get in your next tube. That's the bus. The next tube is the hotel. And the fourth and final tube is the arena. And then you start the whole process over again. Back-to-backs are tough, especially the league sometimes isn't that. I always thought maybe they should be a little more smarter and, you know, putting us in locations that are a little closer, not 3-hour flights when you can get to, like you said, it makes sense, right, to do the Texas Triangle. That doesn't happen all the time. Dallas, mm-hmm. San Antonio, Houston, or maybe OKC would be a nice destination. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we'll leave and fly all the way to Orlando, and it's like, wow, we just lost another hour by the sense of time from the central time zone to the east. So I tell you what, for me, and the guys I travel with, and Chris and Kenny and Madeline, who's one of the PR assistants, it's you have to get into a mindset at the beginning of the season. I'm just trying to get into it now because we travel soon, and it's difficult. You're leaving your family, but also you have to prepare yourself for total focus and living in the tube. And yes, the plane is nice because it's big and everybody has, you know, I sit with Trav Henderson, our producer, and so we can discuss the game and kind of formulate what's ahead. But you're always kind of working, and the food kind of comes and goes if you want it. But then the hotel, waiting for your bag, or you get up and decide to bear the cold of Chicago and wait for the truck to pull up at 2:30 and grab the bag instead of having them knock on your door at 3:30 to roll it in. Usually I try to pick up my bag and be done with it so I can just go to bed. And rest is the most important thing. You got to. Plus, you got to let loose once in a while and go have dinner and, you know, have your beverage of choice on an off day just to kind of get your sanity back a little bit. But it is a grind. I know fans would love to see it. I would wish that more fans could actually experience it. Because these guys are playing. I'm not. I'm just announcing. But they're 22 and they're 25 or they're 31. That's a little easier for them to most likely recover over the term of this trip. But, you know, eating's so important. You've got to hydrate. There's tricks. I almost carry a medicine bag with me just to keep the throat moist, just to take care of myself. You know, wash my hands, Lysol my microphone, that you never know who was on it last, who may have had a flu bug or was chewing tobacco or whatever it may be. So I Lysol down everything. I wash my hands probably 3 times going through the arena and saying hi to people. But before you get on the mic, you know, you just have to kind of prep yourself. So it's you know what's coming. And I think that's something else you can prepare yourself for. There's rarely too many things that jump at you except maybe a plane problem and you have to spend the night and it's 3:00 and you unload and you got to go back to the hotel. That's a bummer because you lose a lot of time and sleep. But on those off days, either you know, you try to sleep in, get some work done, and sometimes it depends too on what Coach Snyder wants, if they're going to try to get these guys out of bed and work them out a little bit or just give them a day of rest. And as the season goes on, usually you see that happen more often as the rest comes in those months of March and April.
See, if I were you, I'd have my own pillow in my seat. Like, do you have your own pillow with you?
No.
How do you get yourself to sleep in different beds every
night?
I'll
be honest. I think my mom would tell you that I can sleep standing up. If I have to, I can. I have always been able to sleep. Now, I'll wake up and have a little trouble maybe going back to sleep. What bugs me is sometimes when you walk into the room, most of these nice hotels have blackout curtains. And so when you turn the lights off, it is pitch black. And as much as you travel, you forget what side of the bed you should get out of if you've got to take that trip to the bathroom, right? And sometimes you panic, like, I don't know where I am, which way is up, or where to go. And I've made many mistakes. It's really weird when you travel. Numbers play a big game in what we do. One night, Dallas, 917, okay? Next night, New Orleans or Chicago, room 1709. So you got to keep straight, or you're in 809 or 908. And so, what floor am I on? And then you'll go and put your key and it doesn't work. And you go, oh my gosh, someone else is in there, you know? So I try now just to jot it down, you know, on a piece of paper real quick, just on a long road trip, because there's multiple times. It's weird how it works. We're usually, all the broadcast staff's on the same floor. But sometimes, you know, they split us up a little bit too. But it's strange. On a multiple road trip, the number of your room becomes more important as you hit your fourth and fifth game, because you just think, where was I in Chicago? And now I'm in Miami. It's bizarre.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
Yeah.
See, I have this weird naming convention, so to speak. For example, if I have the combination of my lock that I use at the gym, you know, I try to liken it to like a player's jersey.
Sure.
But I think that would get really, really, really confusing fast in this situation, because you can't remember if you're talking Donovan's 45 to Peyton Manning's 18 to whatever it is. So that, I don't know. Jotting it down, I think that's a pretty good tip.
You have to. Yeah, there's all sorts of tricks. And that's the thing. I think it's tough to stay healthy. It's difficult sometimes not to feel a little alone or a little... I would say separation anxiety, family. It was tougher when the kids, my sons were all younger. They're all now grown. But in those days, it was like, man, I'm missing out.
Mm-hmm.
And I did the best I could to be there at some of the big occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And CBS at the time was good about trying to work our schedules that way when I was doing football on the weekends. But I you almost have to come back and reintroduce yourself to the family when you're gone for that period of time, because their life continues. And that's the one thing I think fans sometimes forget. We're out on the road, and yeah, you see us on game night, but we're away from our normal routine. And no one, don't feel, I mean, they'll say, Bowler Jack, mm-hmm. Come on, man. Don't give us this crying game. But I think you just have to, my point is, I have to work at it. And my family has to work at it. Because when I come back, I can't really change what they've been going through. I have to find myself, I have to blend back in mm-hmm. to the family, because I've been out of it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a weird feeling sometimes.
I'm sure.
When you're on the road, you know, you're kind of like you're just bouncing around like you're a vagabond. But in reality, you know, you're traveling with your second family, and you really depend a lot on those, on everyone.
No, I think that would be, you know, myself now having young kids, I think that was probably the most difficult part for you. Obviously, you miss your wife and your home, but
sure.
Having your little kids, I think that was probably really tough.
Well, you come back and DJ's got a beard. Or Nick or Brody. But no, it worked out. It worked out the best it could. And I think everyone's involved with that too. I have to give credit to my wife and the kids, who just understood my job. Mm-hmm. And we worked it from there. And there was really no surprises throughout. It's just like, hey, Dad's gone, and here's the reason why.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still gone, 41 times out of the year. It's about 100 nights on the road. And, you know, about you hit the wall a couple of times during the course of the year, just prior to Christmas and about right after, about middle of March, when you realize, wow, you still got 20 to go, playoffs, and you just did your first 35 up through, you know, January, and you're going, man, it's been a long little run here. But you get your second wind.
Mm-hmm. That All-Star break probably helps
out. It helps a lot, yeah.
So switching gears a little bit, when I worked at the Jazz, when you do every game, they all kind of blend together. And obviously there's big moments or there's different opponents and those separate, you know. I always think back to the time that was the exciting time was always just pregame. Kind of that introduction, lights go down, fire, whatever it is. And that was always kind of like the most fun time for me. I always wanted to kind of, if I could, be down on the court. It's just kind of the excitement. It gets you going a little bit. For you, and you've been doing this for so long, is there times that you look forward to? Are there goosebump moments for you still? Like what gives you goosebumps?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think for all the fans, it's more of an entertainment process too. I mean, the Jazz want to make this an all-around great experience for you from the beginning to the end. I get hyped. People always say, "Are you nervous?" Sure. I mean, that's what drives you. I mean, that's the adrenaline of nerves, and it helps prepare you. And then as you sit in your seat and you start to get into the flow, then your mind just totally focuses on the task at hand. I do love the lights out. I do love different arenas and the way that they approach introducing their players. Some are just dynamite. Some are a little bit more or less, you know, energetic. But it's fun to see how different franchises work it to get the fans, you know, up and excited. But there's nothing, Matt, honestly, better than working a tight game from tip off to finish and then having that game end in the last minute or seconds when a player makes a dynamic play, pass, bucket, whatever it may be. And that is what the deciding factor of the game is. Mm-hmm. I mean, and when you watch players of great athleticism, you know, the Jordans of the day and the Kobe's of the day, we call Kobe's last game in LA and it was insane. 60, come on. But they fed him the ball. I'll never forget Jack Nicholson, three seats away from him. He kept looking over and going, "Hey, boys." You know, Harper and I are like, "Good golly, are they going to shut Kobe down?" He goes, "He's going for 30 tonight. Then he goes to 40. Hey, boys, 50 tonight. And then he goes for 60. Wow. I felt like I was on a movie set. I really did. I didn't feel like that game was even real. I feel like it was a Hollywood production. Jack Nicholson is just the Joker, the original Joker, is sitting right to my left. I'm going, "Jack, are you in this movie? Are we doing a movie right now?" Because it was about as magical of an ending that you could write for a player's career. Mm-hmm. And then the confetti comes down. I'm just sitting there going, "Wow, I'm part of history." Even though the Jazz lost, I had to take it in that way. Mm-hmm. Because the respect you have for what Kobe accomplished on the floor was outstanding, and to be able to, you know, call his 60-point game, and I just said, like, I got to take this in. So I kind of just stood there and kind of in this awe moment, and that doesn't happen often, by the way. You just can't get involved in players and their greatness and the awe of that person. You just call games. They're like us. You talk to them on the floor, and they get it. LeBron, you know, he may be a little higher level than some, but still, he's a guy. He's a human being, but with an incredible talent. But those moments, I think, come not often, and you always think again when you're preparing for a game. You think, man, this may be a really lopsided ball game tonight, but in reality, you may have one of your better games of the season. Mm-hmm. It may be Phoenix, who maybe all of a sudden comes out and Booker goes for, you know, 52. The Jazz have to battle back. And those are the games, I think, that are intriguing to me and to make sure that you're prepared for the highs and lows of each night that come. And that's the test, I think, that you have to pass.
Yeah, speaking of that Kobe's last game, so what I was doing is I was calling the game, quote unquote, from my couch because I was doing the social media for the Jazz that night. And I was part of that. And when a game happens like that, there's nothing you can say on social media. You kind of just go quiet. You just kind of go dark. The unfortunate thing is that it was the last game of the year. The Jazz website, for example. The most recent game is kind of the thing that's freshest, whether it's a photo gallery or highlights. So we were trying to figure out ways to, like, put something new there so we can get that, because it was such a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
Right.
Yeah, that was just a weird, you know, we heard about it on social media for a while. They probably still hear about it, you know, when we play the Lakers, you know, Kobe dropped 60 or whatever. But it's such an interesting thing when you're the conduit to the fan, you know, whether you're on television or radio or on social media, is that you are giving the fans the Jazz.
I try, Matt, to live with them the moment. I try to put myself into the fan seat and thinking, okay, look, there's a love-hate relationship with the Jazz and the Lakers, but we're watching something tonight that is ultimately historic and special. And I'm thinking the fan, despite maybe their dislike for Kobe and the Lakers, that they understand that we are watching something special. And I try not to overdo it, but yet I'm also in awe of that moment of what's going on the floor. The Jazz, I think, almost in my mind, I remember, almost thought they were in awe as players who let that 15-point lead just evaporate and watched him do his magical moment. And I thought, wow, guys, do you understand? You're supposed to beat these guys. But I think they almost stood back and go, wow, this is happening, and he's beating us. And that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those rare moments. But I think, you know, again, that love-hate that we talk about, I think true fans understand the game of basketball. We have intelligent fans, in my opinion, who love the game and get it. They don't want to hear too much love about LeBron. They don't want to hear too much love about anybody. But I think they do appreciate fine performances that do come. And it may be detrimental to the Jazz outcome on a particular night, or it may be an exciting finish and the Jazz win. But look, that's also what draws you in. You never know what's going to happen on any given night. And that's what I'm hooked on.
I'm really happy you said that just the way you did, because you may have, I'm sure that there's moments that stick out in your mind, you know, your favorite moments. It's kind of amazing how things happen, but you can't plan for it, right? Live
right.
Sports.
Can't.
So the moment that sticks out in my mind, the miracle in Miami.
Sure.
The most random game, you know, we're playing the big three in the Heat, and the way the game is starting to unfold, you know, from I wasn't doing the social media for the Jazz at that time. I was just a fan watching on TV. I was actually at my wife's office, right, at Richter 7, where she used to work. I was just sitting there one night because she had to work late. And I'm all by myself, and, you know, suddenly Millsap hits a three. And then he hits another three, and it's like, well, we're still down, you know, seven or whatever.
Right.
And then he hits another three. And yeah, it's those moments that just, they come out of nowhere and they become this instant classic. Like that game and that moment, when it happens, it's just like, it's almost magic.
It is. And those are the moments I remember. And those are the moments I live for. Those are addicting. And you don't get them often. But when you do, that's where you just try to take in the moment. And that's where also the miracle in Miami just popped out of my mouth. I mean, you don't write it down and plan for it. I mean, it's just like, my gosh, Millsap, miracle in Miami. I mean, it's all M's, right? But it just kind of, miracle in Miami. And it was. And it was against the big three. And that's the other beauty that made it so special, a road win against LeBron and company, and then Millsap's incredible down-the-stretch performance. I think of it often. I see the video, and I go, man, that guy, Millsap was dialed in, and it was on another planet for about 2 minutes, mm-hmm. and it just happened. And those are moments that can change a season and or change a career, you know, for an individual. And Millsap was one of my favorite players. I mean, Paul was just a hard-nosed dude who loves to play the game. And, you know, he's still doing his thing in Denver right now. But Millsap, terrific, terrific player, terrific player. Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk a little bit about this season. The season is imminent. We were just talking. I don't think that there has been this much excitement around the Jazz, maybe since Stockton and Malone, the glory days.
Right. Well, the expectations are absolutely sky high. And on paper, it's a dynamic combination of players that Quinn Snyder, Matt, can use a lot of different looks on different nights against different defenses. And that's something the Jazz haven't had in years. I think you're right. I mean, I think you go back to, you know, the Hornacek, Big Dog, Carl, John, Jerry. I mean, come on. It doesn't get much better than that. And one guy, and maybe a bad call beat the Jazz. That's another time for another subject. But, you know, and that's left a taste in Jazz Nation's mouth for a long, long time. Look, I grew up in Kansas City. The Chiefs haven't been to the Super Bowl since 1970. I got a bad taste in my mouth. Jazz fans want this to happen again. And, you know, I sense it, and I'm not trying to say this because I'm working and this is what I do, but there is a feel that I can't explain that this is a real possibility of bringing this town to the brink of yet another championship run. And Matt, you know what would happen if this city, this state, this region won a championship? I mean, it would be State Street, Main Street. It would be, you would see the alleged mellow community of Salt Lake actually, I think, just go out of their minds, because that would be, Toronto, you know, lived it with Kawhi. And if the Jazz get to that point again, and I think there's a belief that this team, as it's constituted right now, has the ability to compete with anybody. If they stay healthy, they'll be there, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You bring up Jeff Green. You bring up Ed Davis. Let's bring up Moutier. Let's bring up, you know, the fact that Bojan Bogdanović is 49% effective field goal percentage from three from the left corner. Insane. Bring up Joe in the floor. Bring up Conley. And I think all fans love Ricky. All fans love Jay. All fans love Faves. And all fans love Korver. But the bottom line is, the difficulty of management is sometimes to give up to get something back in return. And that's what they had to do. That's the case. But Conley obviously will only make Donovan better. It opens the floor. No one can sag off defensively and double team when Ricky can't make a shot or has struggles and they all go over and crowd Donovan or Joe and can't get him off the edge on the three-point line and give him some room to work. I just see this team being a free-flowing team. I see a deeper bench. I see more interchangeable parts. And we didn't even talk about Gobert and the defense that he brings. Two consecutive years, Mark Eaton won it twice, but not consecutively. And it's really an amazing thing that we're watching right now. Gobert's 27 and really believes only the best is yet to come. Matt, I try not to get into the fan mode, but be realistic in the way that the West has opened with the injuries and the dismantlement of the Golden State Warriors. No Klay Thompson for most likely the rest of the year, and KD's in Brooklyn after he ruptured the Achilles. That opened the door, and I think the Jazz said it was time. Time to make the big move. Time to show Donovan and Rudy and this fan base that, yes, we're serious about getting back to what was. And I'm ready to play.
You mentioned Rudy. For us, for fans, seeing him when he was a rookie, guy couldn't stay on the floor, couldn't stay out of foul trouble, didn't really grasp the NBA rules from international rules, whatever it is. What an amazing transformation he has become, because he was just this project. I remember when the Jazz, you know, worked him out. He was just this long, tall, his body now, I mean, that guy's put in work.
Yeah, he's got abs for miles.
Oh, yeah. And he knows it, too.
Yeah, he does.
But the amount of work that he has put in, and Rudy is on a Hall of Fame trajectory right now in his career. You mentioned how young he is, two-time Defensive Player of the Year. And you start thinking, how great can this guy be? You know, because he thinks and he believes. And I love Rudy's chip on his shoulder and the way that he wants to work. Oh, you snubbed me for the All-Star game? We'll wait till next year. That kind of attitude, I just love.
Good for a player sometimes. It works. It worked for Malone, too. Remember, I mean, the early days. And I think Rudy kind of falls into that same position where he wears 27 to always remember. That's his draft pick. He was snubbed from the All-Star game. Yeah, he shed tears and people made fun of it. But you know what? Who cares? Mm-hmm. The fact is, he's passionate. And you brought probably the most important word is that's being lost in a lot of professional sports and even collegiately is that nothing's given to you. You got to work. That's spelled W-O-R-K, by the way, for folks. And some individuals, male and female, don't understand that it doesn't happen overnight either, that you don't become a network analyst or play-by-play person overnight. You work to get to those levels. And that's what Rudy is. I mean, you know, is he still a little gawky at times? Yeah, he's 7'1". Could he be stronger in the hands? Absolutely, but he knows it. And he boxes. He tries to get stronger. He broke the league record in dunks last year, and I say he'll exploit that again this season. It was 306. And would he love to have a better hook shot? Most likely. Could he face up to the basket? Working on it. I've seen him hit threes. I doubt Quinn's going to be really knocking on his door to give me a three ball tonight, Rudy. But I still think he's going to surprise us on what he can do because he's never satisfied. A lot of players in any sport that I've covered, they get to a point, Matt, where, okay, I'm good. But Gobert's a special breed. I think fans have got to realize that this team has many Rudys in the sense of how they play and approach the game. And that's why I think this team has the buzz and that special feel to it.
No, it's definitely exciting as a fan. Now, I'm just a fan, right? Like, right. I have a different seat. I'm no longer there. It's no longer my job, and I can just enjoy it. That brings the fan back to you, so to speak.
Absolutely.
So I'm excited for it. I asked Craig to do a little activity here. I'm always curious as how people rank all-time Jazz guys. So I think there's probably 8 guys who are just unanimous. We all agree, oh yeah, they're top 10. But I wanted to know from Craig Bowlerjack's mind, and maybe I'll chip in my opinion, but
please do.
Who would you say, and not necessarily in order, you can give me an order if you want.
Okay.
But who are your top 10 Jazz players all time?
Okay. I'll have to preface this by saying there's a couple of guys that really deserve mention, and I'm going to go ahead and give them the tied for 10 type thing, you know? But I really thought a lot about this, and maybe not in any particular order, but I did kind of put it down in order. And I had this discussion with myself earlier today about Stockton and Malone. I thought, and the first thing that came to me, since I'm from Missouri, was chicken or the egg, you know? My granddad was a cattleman and had a bunch of chickens when I was growing up, and I always asked him, well, what about chickens and where do the eggs come from? Well, you got to have a chicken first or the egg, right? So, you know, that's always been kind of a funny way of breaking them down, but I'm going to put Stockton as my guy on top of the list because Stockton helped hatch Malone, if you get it, plus he's the all-time steals and assists leader, which is staggering, and I don't believe in our time or any time, even though they say records are made to be broken, man, I'm not sure those are attainable. Those are insane numbers, by the way. You'd have to play 30 years at pretty much all-star level to break those records. So that's why I put Stockton. And then Malone was the finisher. Malone's the second-time all-leading scorer, as we know, and a 2-time MVP. But without Stock, maybe not a Malone. But then without Malone, there wouldn't be a Stock. See, that's the beauty of this discussion. But I think those two guys have to be right there, 1-2. Then you go with the early days. I go back when I first came to town, and I got to meet him a few times and talk to him. He was kind of surly, but yet an incredible scorer for his size was Adrian Dantley. Dantley was probably the best guy with his back to the hoop and then turn and hit jumpers or just used his body as well as anybody I've ever seen for his size. He was not a big, big player, but he used it for every pound that he had. I thought Griff was another guy before the knee injury came, was as explosive as any player the Jazz have ever had. Thus, Dr. Duncanstein, and you know, great player at Louisville. Now we get to the debate time. Okay, we can go young, we can go with the current team, and you know, we go bigs. That's where I think next you have to kind of go. Rudy and Mark Eaton. Okay, 2-time defensive players, shot block artists. But yet, I got to give the edge to Gobert because I think of what he does. Stockton and Malone kind of took care of most of it. Mark was a great outlet passer. I remember that. I thought, wow, that's pretty good, you know, for a guy that could get the ball out to Stockton and off and running. But I think Rudy and Mark have to be obviously mentioned together, and I would put Rudy just barely above Mark Eaton. And then I come to Donovan. Okay, people may, well, he needs more time. But I give it to Donovan in that six or seven spot because who he is as a person too, Matt. Hayward, remember, departed. And the Jazz were in disarray. I don't know if you want to say turmoil, but look, they're in trouble. They lost their franchise player who didn't really ever want to be here or never wanted to accept leadership. Donovan Mitchell comes in and says, I'll take those reins. And veterans followed him. And I thought, wow, 19 years old at the time, going on 20. And this guy can earn the respect of veteran players and then do what he did and still with some humor lose to Ben Simmons, the rookie of the year. But I think the media did vote him in as the player, rookie of the year. He won some award. Hornacek's in my discussion. He changed it all with the three ball. Jerry was not a three ball guy, as we all know. Pick and roll, pick and roll, pick and roll, inside play, be tough, defense. But Hornacek worked hard to even get three or four shots. But he was the game changer when he came over in the trade to put the Jazz into the finals. That was that missing piece. So Horny's there. And then you go with a really good discussion group here of Hayward, D-Will, Ricky Green, who was also very instrumental in the early days of making the Frank Layden offense kind of click and got them into their first playoffs. Millsap and Favors. I don't think you cannot discuss the final three or four spots without all those guys. After Hornacek, even if you don't like Deron Williams, he played his best dynamic basketball in a Jazz uniform. He was an all-star here. And he and I have had many conversations since. I was with him the day they traded him and interviewed him in his room in Dallas. And he just said to himself, he goes, you know, probably a mistake on my part. I mean, inside he was a little bit more personable than he let on. And he always told me later that the decision to move away was bad. Boozer told me the same thing. Millsap will always be a favorite, fan favorite. And I think Derek Favors, who just departed for New Orleans with that situation at hand, will always be in that category as well. So there we go. That's kind of where I stand. I know I missed some guys. Harpering would say, what about me? And I tell you another guy that is, you know, he's top 15 is Big T. Big T Bailey brought a lot. And Kyle Korver in two runs brought something to the Jazz that they didn't have. And a class guy from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So I really like your list. I don't think you can argue with it. There is one name that I'll bring up that I think you might have forgotten one guy.
Okay, I'm sure I did. I jotted this down quickly.
No.
I put, and Memo's not far.
And Memo is AK.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I look at Kirilenko and...
5x5.
5x5. He's top 5 or 6 in every statistical category, whether it's games, played, points, rebounds, assists, steals, blocks. I think the longevity of him being here... I would probably slide him in there, like in the top 10, maybe number 9, around there.
Yeah.
And then there's always this conversation with Jazz fans. Do you include this guy or not? Is Pistol Pete? Because he only played in Utah 1 year.
Yeah.
Now, he played in New Orleans for a while.
Right.
But do we claim we have his jersey retired? Does he count? There's that kind of weird, you know, do the Thunder claim Gary Payton? I mean, I know that that's different, right? They're not the Oklahoma City Sonics, but...
Right.
You know, so I don't know if how Pistol Pete factors in there, but I guess it makes for good debate.
Well, his number's there for a reason because he was the face of the franchise for those years in New Orleans. The discussion would probably say, where are you going to go? New Orleans top 10, or are you going to go Jazz? But he was a part of the Jazz franchise, but he was injured. His knee had gone, and I think it was Tom Nosalke, who just recently passed away, was forced to kind of set him on the bench and then went off to Boston in a trade, I think. Before my time, but you know, when you watch the video of Pistol Pete, you know, Ricky Rubio was supposedly the second coming, the way that he had the kind of the floppy hair and the way that he was able to handle the basketball. But like Hot Rod, Pistol was way beyond his years in the sense of in basketball. You know, he changed the game. It was almost globe trottish, you know, and so was Hot Rod. That's probably why he didn't really have that much success in the NBA, because he was more of a showman than he was a ball player when it came right down to it. And Pistol, though, was just an incredibly talented individual. But I think both those names have to be in the conversation. Absolutely. You know, do I take Millsap off? Do I take Favors off? Do I put AK in? I love Kirilenko. You know, he was as, I tell you, he was dynamic. He garnered that max contract, you remember, when Larry had the money to spend, and maybe expected a little bit more out of him. But sometimes in those latter years, my first few years, injuries and hamstrings and quads started to really kind of sneak up on him because of the way he played. You know, he jumped out of the gym. But all those names are beautiful names and that are part of Jazz lore forever. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
One fun little stat that I looked up is, because you mentioned Hornacek and how Coach Sloan didn't like to shoot threes.
Right.
Over Hornacek's entire career, not just Jazz career, he attempted 1.9 a game.
Yeah, and he had to work hard to find that three, by the way.
Yeah.
Coming off a curl, yeah.
But he was an amazing shooter, you know, over 40%, right?
Quick shot,
which is the benchmark.
Yeah. Off his hands, like Korver, with a blink of an eye.
Could you imagine if he played today?
No.
I mean, the numbers he'd be putting up.
Insane.
Yeah.
Insane. And I've talked to Jeff about that before. You know, and again, he always says, yeah. And you know what? Here's another thing, Matt, to talk about. What if Stockton today was playing? What if Stockton wasn't as in tuned and as unselfish as we all think he was on distributing the ball to his teammates, but mostly Malone? What if he was a point guard with three-point ability and could pull the trigger at any time in this game today? He still, I think, would average 6 assists because just the way he plays, but I think he'd pop that three more than anybody can even imagine. And I bet you he'd be a 40+% guy too. Mm-hmm. But he has the moment too. People say, wow, what about Malone? Well, look, he's a two-time MVP, but I think that McCarl, and I see Carl quite a bit, and we don't talk much about that. He loves the past, but he also understands, you know, what was and what didn't happen. But Stockton does have the moment in Houston with the three ball that put the Jazz into the finals. Carl, you know, would like to have had that moment, but his moments kind of are more spread throughout his career by just being a scoring machine. Mm-hmm. Stockton was terrific with steals and assists, obviously, but he still has that moment, I think, that lives in Jazz memory and always will. It was that one moment. And you know what? Maybe we're upon a time, Matt, where there's another moment that is coming, right? That puts the Jazz back into a finals position.
Yeah.
How cool would that be?
I speaking for all Jazz fans, I mean, I think we all crave it. We all want, you know, we love that moment, the shot, but it's been a while. Like, we need something else. We need another signature franchise moment. And it could be this year. Who knows?
Could be a statue moment.
Yeah. No, it's an exciting time. And I think that's what's so great about you is, and talking to you is, we can talk about this forever. Like, I kind of have to, like, make myself leave your house because I don't want to take up all of your time.
No, it's fun.
I could sit here and talk Jazz stuff and just the past. And I think Jazz fans love hearing from you because of who you are and your history. And people really like and love Craig Bowlerjack.
Well,
so
I've been around, and you know, I love the people of Utah. And I call this home. I raised my family here. And people always thought, are you leaving? And I always thought I wanted to go back to Kansas and Missouri. I have a lot of fond memories. But, you know, shortly after I got here, I just kind of felt like this is where I was going to be. You know, not being LDS was interesting to talk personally for a minute. Because when I was at KSL, you know, I got some great stories where, you know, some friends would come by and say, hey, you know, they're looking at you or trying to see if you have, you know, garments and touch my, they pat my leg a lot at meetings and stuff. And I just thought, what's going on, you know? But the beauty, though, is that KSL at that time was just kind of expanding themselves. And there were a few non-LDS workers in the newsroom, but I was kind of the new guy. I thought that was the beginning of a lot of growth. And then the Olympics came and the city and the state, I love it. It's grown up a lot. I think obviously, you know, people love it here. The mountains, there's been a lot of people from, you know, Arizona and California coming in, and, you know, the growth has been good. I grew up here, and basically as a young man, and grew up a family, and my sons, you know, are still here, and my wife's from here. But, you know, she came back in from California when I first met her, so she had moved back. It's an interesting place, man. And I'll tell you a funny story. I remember we were in Oklahoma City a few years ago, and a guy had my jazz hat on. We were out at dinner, and he came up and said, tap me on the shoulder, because I'm really serious about this question. I said, sure. He goes, I'm just curious, man. Is all the stories true? And I said, stories about what? And he goes, how many wives do you have? And I'm like, good grief. And I said, yeah, just kidding him. I said, ah, I got three. And he was like, wow, that's incredible. I said, sir, look, no. And I said, things are much different in the world we live in today. Because what I took a lot of static from when I even came out here was, oh, you're from Kansas, Dorothy, Toto, and Tornadoes. And they thought I had cattle living in my, you know, in my yard. And I thought, no, man. I mean, Kansas City is a very vibrant metropolitan city, you know, and I lived outside of it in a little town called Shawnee Mission. But it's funny how people have certain ways they think who you are. And just to jazz fans, I just thank them for embracing, you know, KSL, Sports Beat. We tried new things, and it's tough to be accepted in the broadcast business. And, you know, the Jazz believed in me, and I thank them immensely, the Miller family and Randy Rigby, who hired me years ago. And you don't, like I said in the beginning, my fear was, look, I know I can't replace Hot Rod because he's really the voice that so many remember and has so many magical moments tagged to his voice and into his name. But, you know, I just enjoy having given the opportunity, Matt, and you know, I think the best is yet to come. That's what I'm excited about, is that we've grown together, I guess is the best way I can put it. And I hope that we can experience a fan base that I've been involved in, that we can experience the ultimate prize. And that to me would be the best moment for myself, the fan base in this state, and every jazz fan and beyond. Maybe it happens. Let's hope it does.
I don't even know how I would react if and when
I don't that, either.
You know,
I really don't. You know, I think it's the culmination of so many years of hard work and some obviously highlights, but also disappointments. But it would be, I don't want to be overdo it, but let's be honest. I think it's magical. It would be one of those Kobe moments where you stand, and I think everyone would just kind of stand and watch the confetti fall. And then my next thought would be parade. That'd be my next thought. Yeah. Like, where is this thing going? And how many miles is it going to go? Let's take it all the way to St. George and back. I mean, that's kind of the feeling that I think the state has. And everybody I know would want to share in it. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, it's based in Salt Lake. But you know what? How many fans we meet in St. George, and, you know, how many fans in Payson and every little corner. And beyond. Mm-hmm. And I hope that someday soon that occurs. Yeah. I really do. I hope we're all a part of it.
The last thing I want to talk about before I let you go, you've been so generous with your time, is you talk about being on the road a lot. There's got to be times where you're passing the time, right? And
right.
I think, so television shows, maybe it's movies, but let's focus on TV shows. Yeah. What's your favorite TV show? What's your go-to? And maybe what are you watching now? Like,
okay.
What do you like?
Well, people may be shocked about this, but I'll start with Westerns. I'm a huge any Western that comes along. Henry, now, and they're the old black and whites, okay? My darling Clementine, Fort Apache, Henry Fonda, John Wayne. Those are the ones that I can watch 40 times over, and I still love every minute. I'm a comedy guy. So Westerns and comedy, you know, I know it sounds crazy, but I can still find a laugh a minute with Dumb and Dumber, Tommy Boy, Waterboy. I know those are just mindless comedies, but hilarity. And even the old Doris Day, Cary Grant stuff, you know, that comes on TC, Turner Classic Movies on occasion. So I'm a movie guy on the road, so I'll surf around. And then my favorite sitcom of all time, I'll never get tired of two shows that I record and watch when I'm late at night or just kind of bumming and want to get picked up. But I have all the episodes of MASH, the best of the first four seasons when Frank's there and Henry. And then Klinger, of course, and Colonel Flagg, the CIA guy who is just a joke, just cracks me up. I'm a big Andy Griffith fan. Don Knotts, I could cry laughing every time I watch the guy. And then probably, I know, man, people are laughing at me right now, but I still get a kick out of Gilligan's Island. That's crazy, isn't it? And now I love History Channel, Travel Channel. I'm intrigued with Ghost Adventures and Ancient Aliens.
Okay.
Yeah, that stuff just blows me away. And I just go, wow, makes you think. And they're well produced. And Ghost Adventures, I just am intrigued of that whole thing. They do a good job with it. But I love anything with history. History Channel has so many cool things, even Korea, World War II, you know, the days of Nazi Germany, and just the whole aspect of the whys and hows and where we go from here. But, you know, movies, History Channel, that type of stuff. And I do carry, the guys kid me a lot, I still have a computer that has a CD. I can pop it out and slide in a couple of CDs with my MASH collection. And so I can watch those on a plane if I need to on a long flight. I'm still looking for other things.
Okay.
And I'm a big Seinfeld fan, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where we can connect right
George
there.
George just is unbelievable. So is Kramer.
I mean,
unbelievable.
It's funny. I was just talking to my wife today about Seinfeld. I mean, I'm the guy who watches Seinfeld every night. Mm-hmm. And I asked
I do too. 11:35 to 11:35. Yeah.
I asked my wife, and this might be an impossible question. I said, if you had to take one of the main four casts and you had to remove one.
Mm.
I know it's impossible. Can you even say a name? Because from my seat, I'm like, okay, well, you have to have Jerry because he's the show.
He's the anchor.
And then my favorite character is George.
Yeah.
Like, so you have to have Jerry and George.
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine not having Kramer walk in, sliding, doing his, what would you call it? His very physical comedy.
Yeah.
So does that leave us with Elaine?
I guess so.
But it has to have the female presence and her little funny and aggressive and kind of nasty attitude towards them when she gives them the push.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if you can. I don't know if the show would ever have been the same. It's like Friends. Who do you take out of that group?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a Ross guy. Most people think I'm crazy because I like Ross on Friends. But it's funny.
And Joey, hey, you know, how you doing? How you doing?
The pilot episode of Seinfeld didn't have Elaine in it.
Oh.
So I'm one of these Seinfeld nerds, right? I have the DVDs. And a lot of people who've watched those, the NBC executives said, we need some kind of a female.
Sure.
And in the pilot episode, it's a different coffee shop. There's a waitress, you know, redhead waitress for people who've seen the pilot. And she was meant to be just, they go to the coffee shop and they kind of interact with her.
Okay.
And the executives are like, no, I think we need something, whether, you know, an ex-girlfriend or whatever. And then Elaine, who Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who had been on SNL, she came in, and obviously she's just amazing. Like, she might be the best, at least in the last 50 years. I mean, you can go back to Lucille Ball or whatever, way before, you know, really my time, but the most perfect comedian, female comedian there is. I mean, if you take Seinfeld and Veep, I don't know if you've seen Veep.
Yes.
But that is,
yeah. She's,
it's amazing. Yeah. And she is amazing. Like, so I don't know if I can take Elaine out. So does that mean I'm left with Kramer, who's the perfect next door neighbor, who is also based on a real life neighbor.
On his real life friend neighbor, yeah.
So yeah, maybe you can't do it. I don't know
if the show would ever be the same without all four. And mm-hmm. that's a great compliment to them. Mm-hmm. And comedically, I love it. I think, you know, what's fun, what's crazy, and here we're talking about comedy and television shows, but the thing about the great comedies, I think that they are able to somehow intertwine three stories per episode that involve the characters, and they would go away, but it's all flowed. Same thing with Friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, MASH had the same type of concept, and it's really amazing. You know, what does Jerry always say? A show about nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And in reality, it's kind of that way. It's just like living life and having a talk at the coffee shop or some bad relationship with a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You know, the one when George lost his fiance with the envelopes. That's brilliant. Come on, I mean, that's just come on. Whoever
feels so bad for Susan.
I did. Yeah, like oh, she's just you know bad cheap. That's what it was. It was cheap.
Yeah, George like flips to the very back.
Yeah, 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 the very the lowest cost invitations possible. But you know there was just so many funny moments in that, and then you got to throw in the guy Newman. I mean, that guy made some great you know appearances, and was always you know bothering Jerry as well. So,
Well, Craig, I've had you for over an hour. You've been the man. You are the man. Thank you. This podcast is really new. It's you know meant to just kind of be these kind of conversations.
I love it. Yeah.
Not everyone's Craig Bowlerjack, but I think everyone's going to love listening to this.
Let's do it again. We'll do part two, and
I'd love to,
we'll talk westerns and and you know and again too. We maybe you know mid season we'll have a better idea with what direction the Jazz are going, and we'll have a better feel for the. I think the chemistry. That sounds really good on paper, but you know the Ed Davises. Does Emmanuel Mudiay actually you know take the backup spot? Does Royce O'Neal you know come into another level? You know there's so many storylines that intrigue me this year. You know we got to do a follow up because you know if Rudy stays healthy and the rest of this team, they're going to be difficult to stop. And I think Jazz fans have to know too. Matt, that the West is a buzzsaw, and that every game that the team plays is going to be so important night in, night out, home and away. And I don't know how the series will go. They may beat up one another. 48 wins may do it. 50 may do it. But I think that seeding will be so important. The Jazz have been kind of saddled with that five spot for a while, and I think home court would play a huge role for them this year. And, you know, the Clippers are good. Let's face it, with Kawhi and Paul George, well coached by Doc Rivers. Maybe some trouble in Houston. Westbrook, I'm not sure the personalities clash. You know, they will clash with Harden. And we'll see how LeBron handles Anthony Davis and time. Father Time, the clock's ticking on LeBron. We'll see if that team stays healthy as well. But I think the Jazz are going to be in the thick of it all year. So let's play.
Yeah. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, pal.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Jazzed. And it's an exciting time to be a fan.
Thank you. Let's do it.
Yes, sir.